Ice cold beer!
Popcorn, peanuts, Cracker Jack.
I know what the big deal about Cracker Jack is. Did you ever go and buy a pack of Cracker Jack thinking you'd get a prize and find no prize in the box?
Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
To the ball game, take me out to the crowd, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back. We'll root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. 1, 2, 3 strikes you out at the old ball game.
All right. Welcome back to the Bench Jockeys here on 101.5 UMFM. I'm Michael Alves. No Brian Svensson this week, but joining me from the Dugout Library, a new wing of our dugout, my guest today, Heidi L.M. Jacobs, the author of the forthcoming book, 1934, The Chatham Colored All-Stars Barrier Breaking Year, June 6th via Biblioasis. She joins me on the phone. Welcome to the show, Heidi.
Hi, Michael. Nice to be here.
My pleasure to have you on and to talk about this book. Now, you've written a Leacock winning humor book, Molly the Mall. You wrote you co-wrote 100 Miles of Baseball with Dale Jacobs, past guest here on the Bench Jockeys. But this book, I guess, kind of predates both in terms of its genesis, because this goes back to a project that started like almost a decade ago. Is that right?
No, I think it started about 2015, so it kind of hits between the novel and 100 Miles. So, yeah, it's been a while, but...
So the Breaking the Color Barrier project was a, like, archival project that started, or at least kind of roped you in because you're at the University of Windsor. Is that kind of... Do I have the details correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I got a text one day from a colleague in history, Miriam Wright, and she said she had just met this lady at an event she was at in Chatham, and she said, would you be interested in maybe helping us? This lady's father-in-law was Boomer Harding, and he was a baseball player and a hockey player, and he was on the 1934 Chatham Colored All-Stars, the first black team to win an Ontario Baseball Association championship, and 1934, would you be interested in helping us make a website? And I absolutely, like, this just seemed so amazing. And I was hooked instantly. And then when I saw the scrapbooks that Pat Harding had created for her father-in-law, Boomer Harding, I thought, this is incredible. And so we got some grants and ended up working on the Breaking the Color Barrier website. And yeah, that sort of started the whole ball.
So did you have a sense when you started that project that there was a book in this for you, or was that just not even part of the picture at that point?
I don't know. We had originally sort of joke about it now. We said, oh, we should be able to finish this by August. And that, this was in May of 2015. And we're still working on this project. But once I saw the scrapbooks and really started getting into them, I knew the website was bigger than, just a quick digitization project. And then the more I worked on this project, the story was so compelling, and I just had to pursue this book. It just wouldn't let go of me. So that's how I got it. So I have been working on this, pretty much, I don't know, what, 6-7 years. So yeah, I was pretty hooked.
So with a digitization project, like, have you done other digitization projects before? And, like, is it mostly kind of just, like, making sure everything's scanned properly and archived and labeled, and then something about this just drew you in? Or was this the first one and this is kind of how it manifested?
Yeah, that was our very first one. And my colleague had contacted me because we had just started at our library at University of Windsor, the Center for Digital Scholarship. And I'm like, oh, well, this should be a straightforward project we could finish off in the summer. But what we ended up doing is we were originally just going to digitize that. And then in talking with the Hardings, they kept saying, you know, there's much, much more to the story than just the scrapbook. You need to talk to the other family members and descendants. So we ended up doing a pretty large oral history with the community members. And I think we did about almost 20 interviews with people and collected a whole bunch more material. And we developed a traveling exhibit and a set of baseball cards, and Scott Chandler, the cartoonist, did a cartoon for us. And so, like, it really started getting quite large. We partnered with the Chatham Sports Hall of Fame and the Chatham-Kent Black Historical Society and got a provincial Trillium grant that funded this. And so, yeah, it got much bigger than we had imagined in the first days. But once we got into it, we realized this is a project definitely deserving of that scope.
So it kind of goes wider and wider. Then how do you narrow things down? Because especially this book is just 1 year, really,
yeah,
ultimately, in the story of the Chatham Ulsters. I mean, you obviously do talk a little bit about a couple subsequent seasons in your concluding chapter, but the focus of this book is the prize-winning year.
Yeah, I mean, it's the year they're most famous for, and it was a big year, and they're barrier breaking, and it had the most press coverage too. The journalist that I rely on, Jack Calder, is fantastic, and he gave me so much material to work on, not just, you know, box scores and game recaps, but he really got into the personality of the team and the sort of off the field stuff. So there was an awful lot there. So yeah, 1934, there's just such a fulsome record of it. But I did definitely wanted to get into the other seasons, because they had broken some barriers in 1934, but that doesn't necessarily mean that those barriers or the obstacles they encountered were dismantled or gone. And so I definitely wanted to follow up, and, you know, this isn't a story of, you know, the team that won and then went on to greater and greater things. There were some kind of sad things that happened after that, so I wanted to definitely touch on those.
Yeah, you have a great line. I'm going to totally botch or paraphrase it here, but that a broken barrier is not a dismantled system, essentially.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's one of the, you know, even though they beat white teams and they won the championship, that doesn't mean that societal attitudes have changed very much at all. I think it changed for sure how the community was starting to see themselves, and that was really huge, but there's still, well, even today, still lots of obstacles that are still firmly in place.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Jack Calder and relying on a lot of his coverage from the time. Like, do you feel this book would have been possible were it not for, like, the way he wrote about this? Like, that if it was just box scores and stuff like that, you might not have necessarily had as much of the personality and detail?
Oh, yeah, and absolutely. And his writing is so fantastic. I think it's a tremendous sports writing example. And I really found it when I was trying to piece together the playoffs and the final games, when they would go for away games and Jack Calder wouldn't be on the road with them. And so I would have to rely on other towns' material. And I just didn't have the record. I just didn't have the detail. And he was such a great, he was almost, I don't know, it was all true, but, like, you know, he wrote like a fiction writer. He set the scene. We got the characters. We got the sounds of the ballpark, and that really helped me a lot. So, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why piecing together the other years was a little more difficult, because we didn't have his reliable supply of details and insight.
Now, you incorporate, you know, some of the biography and story of each of the individual people, but at different points in the book, right? Like, it's not like you introduce a cast of characters right off the hop and then, mm-hmm. you know, follow them throughout the season or something. How did you decide on that as part of kind of the flow of this book?
Well, that was, I think, the most difficult part. I researched it for years and years, and then I took about 6 or 8 months just to organize my research into ways that would be useful as I wrote it. And then the writing of it took pretty much almost full time for a couple of years. And it just took me a while to figure out what would be the most compelling way to do that. And, you know, you could have a chapter about the season, what happened, here's the context, here are the players. But it seemed a lot more narrative, it seemed to be a bigger narrative momentum if I put it in sort of month to month, and then we could build on it and we could get into the rhythms of the baseball season. And then it also really helped me to figure out, say this month, Flat Chase had a really great month, so this would be a really great time to introduce him. It was just a matter of trying to figure out what is the best pacing, what makes it a good story, how does it move along, and so that once I sort of figured on that 1934, sort of preseason, postseason structure, going month by month and building, and the players made a lot more sense that way.
You mentioned Flat Chase, and obviously alluded to Boomer Harding as well, that these individual characters, did you get kind of a favorite as you kind of read about them or piece together their lives? Like I know, knowing you for years, you were a Curtis Granderson fan back in the day. did you find a player comp that you were like, oh, this is the guy, this is the one I'm most interested in just because of their style of play, the way it's described?
Yeah, it was really tough. I've, at my desk at work and my desk at home, I've got a postcard of the team. So I just, they're always sort of staring at me. And I sometimes think, gee, which jersey would I buy, if they had them? And I do think about that, yeah. What would go beside my Curtis Granderson? I think it would be tough. It would really, I think I would have to go with Boomer because I just have great affection for him in the Harding family. But there are so many really fantastic players that I had to remind myself that I never met them, and I never saw them play. But I do feel like a total fan of many of the players.
You do write a few instances of, there was a player where there just wasn't information, right? Whether they were with the team briefly or didn't have quite the impact and didn't get the coverage. Did that unsettle you at all? Did you feel oh, this is too bad? I can't figure out who this person was and write their story?
Yeah, I did feel like I was leaving a couple players out. Some of them I just didn't have as much information about them as people or as players, or there were some players we had a lot of material about from Jack Calder, but we never found a descendant, so we couldn't interview them. So, I wished the other people, descendants, I would have loved to talk to about their lives after, and I would have liked to have been able to get into much more detail about everybody, but I think given the record as it is, we did pretty well in finding out some information. But this is definitely not open or closed. It's still an open case. I think if we still find some people, we would love to include more in the research.
So this project, you mentioned Pat Harding already, that it was her scrapbooks of her father-in-law that, you thank her in the credits of the book and dedicate it in part to her, that, mm-hmm. If it hadn't been for these people kind of preserving this project wouldn't exist, this story wouldn't exist. Can you wrap your head around that something like this could vanish were it not for some individual people kind of feeling it was important?
Oh, yeah. And I thought about this all the time about how all the, it was Boomer Harding's mother who first clipped out those, and also Flat Chase's wife clipped out a bunch of things. And there are a couple little scraps that I never, ever, ever would have found if those women hadn't clipped them out and put them in their scrapbook, and that, the scrapbook didn't get lost or wasn't eaten by mice or in a basement flood or an attic leaking or anything. And I just think all the things that had to happen to keep these documents safe, and then they eventually found their way to our library. There's some days I just think, wow, this is so close to just not being documented. Of course the memories are still alive in the community and the family members, but I think having that print record has been really fantastic in shaping the story.
As far as kind of gaining information to write the book, how heavy were you leaning on the archives versus then doing follow-up interviews and sitting down with people? Is it relatively evenly balanced, or did you find you were kind of on your own a lot of the time and then just kind of fleshing things out with some questions for people, or how did that work out?
Well, we had originally done a series of interviews with the a number of the descendants for the Breaking the Color Barrier site. And we spent a lot of time thinking about which questions we would have, and so we had transcripts of those. And so I went over those really, really carefully, and there were some subsequent interviews that filmmaker LaShawn Harris, for example, did over the summer, and I was able to witness those, and I got transcripts from that. So I got a bit more information there. And there was also, in the late 70s, early 80s, it appears to be a provincial, Ontario provincial project that had community researchers going into various communities and interviewing multicultural towns. And there was someone, actually it was Boomer Harding's sister Wanda, who interviewed a whole bunch of Chatham residents, including about four or five of the players. So I had those interviews as well. And then sometimes I just emailed or called people and said, how did that work? Or do you know this person? Or where is this referring to? And so I really drew on lots and lots of that personal information that was either we got through our interviews or other interviews, or that I just could call someone. And again, you know, memory is a fragile thing too. And I often think about if those interviews hadn't happened in the 70s and 80s, we wouldn't have all the insight that we got from, say, King Turrell about the baseball season and what it was like. So there are all sorts of points in this since 1934 that people have been collecting stuff, not knowing where they would end up. And I'm just grateful for all of those people too. But I also spent weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks reading digitized microfilm and actual microfilm. So yeah, it was many, many sources to build this book.
Did you have any aha moments? Like, were there any things like in either in talking to someone, something, a light bulb went off, or in you know, scanning all of those digitized documents, did you find something that was like kind of like that really brought things into focus for you for this story?
I think there were a couple sort of big and small aha moments. I think one of the things that I was really moved by, I was interviewing one of the nephews of one of the players, Mr. Talbot, and the love that he had for his uncle, who was sort of a father figure for him. It really reminded me that this isn't an academic exercise. This is people's lives and their fathers, and I knew that, obviously, but it really hit home to me that so much of the work that had gone into preserving this memory was rooted in just this real deep affection for their family members and a sense of grief of them being lost. And I think they really enjoyed having their memories preserved and thus preserving their families. So that element of love and affection was really quite meaningful as well. And then the other thing that really kind of blew my mind was I had borrowed a scrapbook from the Chase family that their mother had created, and we digitized it, and I had looked over this thing over and over and over and over and over again. And then one day I was just flipping, looking for something, and I found this little tiny, it was about maybe 3 inches long and 2 inches wide. It was a letter to the editor from someone who signs themselves a colored fan. And it takes Jack Calder to task for not seeing an incident as racially charged. And it referred to some other newspaper articles that I never would have found in other papers. And it just really reminded me how, well, first of all, to hear a voice of a citizen, an East End of Chatham resident, talking about the racism that this team was facing in really overt terms, to see that published in the sort of letters to the editor section was really quite mind-blowing to me. And then having access to those feelings and that voice, and how I had almost not seen it, and this was quite late in my research process that I actually found it. And just the sort of archival miracle that someone clipped it out and taped it in, and it has survived all these years. Those were all pretty staggering moments, I think, for me for this project.
Yeah, so that's the response to Calder's piece. Did that force you to kind of go back and relook at Calder's piece, or had you even looked at that piece at that point?
Well, I had. It was from 1935, so I had read it, but I didn't really think about it. But it really made me realize that, you know, as insightful and detailed as Calder was, there were definite blind spots with him, as with everybody, right? I think they didn't, I guess the accusation, just for people who haven't read the book, but the accusation is that the All-Stars were playing a too rough baseball game, and that kind of aggression should not be tolerated. And Calder kind of agreed. And then the fan wrote back and said, okay, well, yes, but the All-Stars are only reacting to what's been given. You didn't see this happen. You didn't see this happen. You didn't see that in the newspaper, you know, all sorts of horrible names were used to describe the players and their mothers and girlfriends and wives. You're not seeing that. And I think that was a really powerful moment, probably for Calder. He ended up sort of writing a follow-up piece that sort of nodded a little bit to what a powerful team this was. And so it really is sort of a reminder that as much as we would like to look at newspapers as sort of authoritative, unbiased, totally reliable source, you know, even newspapers which we like to trust are, you know, have some blind spots that we need to consider and pay attention to.
And because they're written by people, they're not neutral.
Exactly, exactly. I think there's a tendency, especially with historic newspapers, like, well, it's in print, so it must have been true. Well, it's, you know, it's still a single person's perspective for sure.
You were talking about those, you know, collections of clippings and stuff being collected as a result of love and admiration for these players. Did you feel like any trepidation or hesitation about honoring that love and doing right by the people who'd collected all these things over the years?
Yeah, that was a huge, huge concern of mine. And actually, even at our first project level, we wanted to make sure that we were doing right by the community. The story of the All-Stars, and you look at what the players say and the families say, the idea of respect is just constant throughout. And more than anything, the All-Stars were really about demanding and receiving respect, both on and off the field. And I wanted to make sure that our web project showed that level of respect. And my intention absolutely for the book was that it would show my deep affection and respect for the community who really helped me along this project. And so I did spend a lot of time throughout the whole time talking with various members of the community about this and making sure that they were okay with everything step by step. And so I wanted them to feel included in this process. And I also wanted to tell the story as much as possible using the actual voices of the players as well and the descendants. So I really wanted them to feel like I'm not writing the story. I'm just trying to piece it together and stitch it together and collect it. So that was sort of my hope for the project.
So kind of like the way a documentarian would have the participants or the people recollecting it and there's less of an authorial voice to it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that affection and the rawness of some of the emotions that they felt really also come through. And so, yeah, my favorite parts of the book are the ones that are quotes and sections from the interviews. Right. Some of them are very, very powerful.
This story, I mean, it's obviously set in Chatham, but takes you all around Ontario and across the river from Windsor to Detroit. I mean, is this just kind of part and parcel of like the interconnectedness of that area and that era of baseball? Or like, I mean, obviously you and Dale did a, you know, similar kind of circuit around your home with 100 mm-hmm. miles of baseball. But like, is this just kind of part and parcel of the way things are with Ontario baseball?
Absolutely. And actually, I think in 1934, it was even more so. The border is a lot more rigid right now, but it was very, very fluid between Windsor in Detroit. So for your listeners who don't know, Chatham is like 45 minutes from Windsor, which is right across the river from Detroit. And so there was lots and lots and lots of movement. And I've done a fair bit of research looking at the Windsor baseball games in 1934 and seeing how many Detroit teams were coming over, black teams and white teams were coming over. A lot of the players, especially Platt Chase, who grew up in Windsor, grew up playing against Detroit teams in Windsor and Detroit. So it really is, it's an Ontario story, but it has some really important connections with the 1930s baseball in Detroit. And of course, we had a couple of players that came from Detroit to play for the All-Stars in 34 as well. So it's a very fluid region. So it is about Chatham, but it's about something bigger too.
And it really ties into not just the baseball of the time, but the like social injustice of the time as well. Like that this is any story ultimately is, you know, not just limited to the diamond or the like workplace or something, that like it all sort of spills over because it's all human and it's wrapped up in each other's lives, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And Boomer Harding and his son Blake also talk about how once they won that championship, they became known around town, and there was doors opened up. You know, Boomer became the first black mailman in Chatham, and his brother became the first black policeman, and career opportunities that weren't offered to them before started opening up. So, and that would not have happened if they hadn't had the success on the field, I'm sure.
One thing that I think the book does is show that, you know, our rosy-colored view of, you know, the fact that the Underground Railroad ended in Canada, that things were great once black people, you know, escaped the South, is not necessarily the case, and that there was some very obvious and surface-level racism, as well as some, you know, under-the-surface racism that the black people who came from the States or who were related to those who came from the States experienced, and that this book really doesn't shy away from exploring that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's significant. I think when you look at histories of the Underground Railroad from the U.S. perspective, I always say they're kind of like those Canadian or the U.S. weather maps where there's no weather in Canada, you know, it just ends. And that happens, I think, a lot with the Underground Railroad. Oh, they left and they were free and everything's great. But I think one of the things that's kind of interesting, actually, is after the abolition of slavery happens, the black population in Canada drops really, really consistently through each decade, people going back, looking for family. And partially, I think it's people reconnecting with their family. But I often think, well, they didn't stay here. So there were certainly some challenges and issues that are quite significant that people were facing. And even though things weren't legislated in the same way, that doesn't necessarily mean that there weren't racist practices going on, for sure.
No doubt. This is a fascinating story. It's out June 6th via Biblioasis, 1934, the Chatham Colored All-Stars, barrier-breaking year. Heidi, do you have another baseball book in you?
I don't think so. Both of them were sort of things that I hadn't quite intended, but they just sort of happened, and they were quite lovely projects to work on. But who knows what the next years will bring.
Well, standing invite, if you ever have another baseball book, to come on the Bench Jockeys, we'd love to talk about it. Heidi, thanks very much for taking some time out of your day, and congratulations on the release of the book next month.
Great. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me, Michael.
Wonderful. Well, with that, we're going to hand things over to Dr. Renewable after these commercial messages.
Strike three, you're out!